May 1940, there were 1/3 of a million British and French soldiers who were trapped on the Belgian coast of the North Sea as the German Luftwaffe and the German army were closing in with the anticipated slaughter of many of those soldiers and the capture of the rest. It was a bleak time for the Allied forces. Prime Minister Winston Churchill warned the British House of Commons to expect hard and heavy tidings. The British Navy estimated that of the 3 million who were trapped, at most, they could rescue 45,000. But then the people of England did something historic. They set sail across the English Channel and into the North Sea with a flotilla of every boat that they could find that would float. Tugboats, fishing boats, pleasure craft, fire ships, private yachts, barges, even a flat-bottom paddle boat from the River Thames. Most of these 700 boats had never been to sea before. And yet, in their combined effort, they rescued 338,226 soldiers, most of whom otherwise would have died or been captured. Winston Churchill called it a miracle, and the British press said it was a disaster turned into a triumph. The evacuation of Dunkirk is the story of the British using everything that they had in order to save lives and to save England. And it was the same kind of desperate ingenuity that drove St. Paul in a story from the first century in Jerusalem. Not for the sake of country or to save an army, but to advance the cause of Jesus Christ and to save his own life. So let me tell you the story, and then we'll read from Acts 22 and 23. Paul visited Jerusalem in order to take money to the poor, thousands and thousands of dollars. But the generosity was soon forgotten when there was a religious controversy that arose. There was a rumor going around that Paul had taken a man named Trophimus, who was a pagan Gentile, into a restricted area of the Jerusalem temple. He hadn't. It wasn't true. But people believed the rumor, and there was a mob riot on the streets of Jerusalem. They were just about ready to beat Paul to death when the Roman commander, a man named Claudius Lysias, came to the rescue with Roman soldiers. He rescued Paul, arrested him, they carried him to the barracks adjacent to the temple grounds, and Paul asked if he could speak to the crowd. He was given permission, and surprisingly, the crowd was quiet while Paul presented his 5-minute faith story. But then, this same crowd, when they heard Paul talk about pagans becoming connected to God without first converting to become Jews, well, they started the riot all over again. And speaking of Paul, they started to shout out, "Rid the earth of him! He's not fit to live!" And the crowd became crazy. They yelled and they shouted. They ripped off their outer garments. They reached out and they picked up the dirt off the ground and threw the dust up into the air. And the commander had to take his soldiers and rescue Paul one more time. But he was trying to figure out what was going on. What was so intense here? What was underlying these riots and causing civil stress? And when he questioned people, nobody could give him a straight answer. When he would listen to what the crowd was shouting, he couldn't understand them because Aramaic wasn't his mother tongue. And so he decided to resort to a tactic all too frequently used by the Romans, and that was to gather intelligence by torture. Not for punishment, but just to get information. The Romans had very little respect for the sanctity of human life or for human rights. And so the commander ordered that Paul be taken into their torture area and tortured until he would give the information that the commander wanted, which, of course, is, on the face of it, a problem, because we know that many people, when tortured, will say whatever they think they need to say in order to get the torture stopped. This particular form of torture was to, first of all, strip a man naked. And that was humiliation and torture all of its own. And then to stretch him out. And then a trained centurion would take what the Romans called a flagellum. And it was a wooden handle with leather strips that had embedded into them pieces of stone and glass and bone. And then they would whip the tied up man until his flesh was ribboned and raw, not just his back, but his entire body, front and back, in order to extract information. We know that many people died from this type of flogging, and that a high percentage of those who survived ended up being scarred and crippled for the rest of their lives. Just before the beating was to begin, Paul, already tied up and stretched out, turned to the Roman centurion and said, "Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty?" And at that instant, the whole process stopped because it was illegal. Roman law forbid the beating of a Roman citizen. So the centurion went to the commander and asked him what to do. And the commander, who had distanced himself because he didn't want to witness this distasteful torture firsthand, decided that he needed to come and quiz Paul to find out if this was just a ploy or he really was a Roman citizen. In those days, there were two ways that someone became a citizen. One was by birth, and the other was by reward. So if someone did something heroic, then the government would reward that person with citizenship. However, there were those who would bribe the rewarders, even though they hadn't done anything heroic, so that they could become Roman citizens. When the commander came and quizzed Paul, he admitted to something that's kind of surprising he would admit to, and that is that he had paid a big price in order to get his citizenship. Paul responded that his father was a Roman citizen and that he was born to Roman citizenship. The commander and the centurion at this point were clearly scared, because if they were ever caught beating and torturing a Roman citizen, they would not only lose their commissions in the Roman army, but they possibly would lose their lives. You know, we could wish that they held to a higher ethic, that they didn't want to torture people because it was not the ethical and right thing to do. But these were pagans. And as pagans, they were more intimidated by the possibility of breaking the law and being punished themselves than any ethical standard. There is a question, though, of why Paul, at the last minute, would tell them he was a Roman citizen. Because he had previously been beaten, and there's no indication that he had told them then that he was a Roman citizen. Or if maybe he did, it wasn't respected, and he was beaten anyway. However, this time, at least, it seems the reason he insisted upon his rights as a citizen was because God had called him to spread the gospel of Jesus all the way across the empire, all the way to Rome, and eventually, he hoped, all the way to Spain. And he knew that if he was beaten to death or he was permanently crippled, that the chances of his fulfilling the mission of Jesus were impossible. So to fulfill the cause of Jesus Christ, he exercised his rights as a Roman citizen. But that left the commander stuck, because he still needed to figure out why this was going on. And now his way for getting the information was restricted from him. So he decided to turn Paul over to another government where they could get the information out of him without having to respect Paul's Roman citizenship or Roman laws. He would turn Paul over to the Jewish authorities. So the commander convened a meeting of the Sanhedrin, which was the Supreme Court of Israel, and personally delivered Paul to the court chambers. When Paul walked in, he talked right away, apparently the first to speak, saying, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." In other words, Paul started out by saying, "I am innocent." Well, he hadn't been charged with anything. And he insisted, "Whatever you were going to say that I did wrong, I didn't do it. I'm innocent. I have an absolutely clear conscience." When he did this, Ananias, the high priest, who was like the chief justice of the Supreme Court, ordered those around Paul to slap him across the face for what he had said. And it could have been for a number of reasons. It could be because Paul started out by saying, "my brothers," instead of using the usual court language and protocol. And Paul was implying that they were his peers, that they were his equals. Or it could be that Ananias was just irritated by this troublesome prisoner insisting that he was not guilty when he hadn't even been charged with breaking any laws yet. Whatever the reason, when Paul was slapped, he fired back an insult right at the high priest. He said, "God will strike you, you whitewash wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." And the chief justice did not take well to what Paul had to say. There's a reason that he said what he said. You know, sometimes if you don't know the background, you don't recognize an insult when you hear one. And what happened here was that Paul was speaking to a belief in the first century Jewish community that if you touched a dead person or even brushed up against or bumped into a grave, a tomb, that you were what they called ceremonially unclean, which meant that until you went through a purification process, you couldn't go into the temple, you couldn't participate in the worship of the Jewish community. So in order to avoid this, many religious people, they wouldn't even touch their own relatives when they were dead. They would hire that out. And they whitewashed all of the graves in and around Jerusalem, so that if you saw a whitewashed tomb, you would know to step aside so you wouldn't accidentally bump into that grave. So Paul was essentially saying to the high priest, "You are just like a tomb. You are whitewashed and look clean and nice on the outside, but you are rotten and decaying on the inside." It was highly offensive what Paul said. And you can't help but wonder why he would be so rude to a person in such a high position. It could be that he was so rude to him because basically it was true. This guy was a disaster in a high-level religious public office. The Jewish historian Josephus tells us things about Ananias. He was greedy, he was selfish, he was self-righteous, he was manipulative, he was guilty of malfeasance in office. He did a lot of terrible things. So it wasn't that what Paul said was untrue. This guy was a bad person. However, I think it's more likely that Paul just lost his temper. And his temper flared up and his mouth was too quick. What he should have done was whispered, 1, 2, 3, 4. He should have counted to 10 before he mouthed off. But, you know, he didn't. And let me tell you something that Paul wrote to new Christians in Corinth just before this happened. He wrote them a letter, and the words are recorded in 1 Corinthians 4:12. Paul wrote, "When as Christians we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly." None of which he did. So Paul did not practice what he preached. And why would that be? Because he was just like us. As Christians, we often have very high standards and very lofty goals, but our mouths are too quick to speak, and our minds are too fast to blurt something out that later we may well regret and are sorry that we ever said what we said or did what we did. Paul perhaps thought of those words and quickly, sort of, apologized to Ananias, the high priest, for what he had said. But then he did something else. He sort of took over the proceedings. He's the defendant kind of running the whole court trial. And he recognized something. That was that the Sanhedrin, which was 70 men who were leaders of Israel, not all 70 may have been there that particular day, but they sort of had a surface compliance and friendly agreement, but deep down they were immensely divided between two political religious groups, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees were pro-Roman government. They did not believe in most of the Old Testament. They did not believe that there were angels or spirits, and they didn't believe that there was life after death. They taught that when you're dead, that's it. The Pharisees disagreed at virtually every point. So the Pharisees were opposed to the Roman government. They believed in all of the Old Testament. They believed in spirits and angels, and they believed that there was life after death. So Paul, recognizing these deep divides that aren't normally allowed on the surface, stands in front of this group and says, I am a Pharisee. I am the son of a Pharisee. And the only reason I'm here is because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. And then he sort of stepped back to watch what their response would be. And they started ripping into each other in a ferocious argument. And the Pharisees in the group sort of came to Paul's defense, saying, well, if he's a Pharisee, then he must be right, because all Pharisees are right. And they defended Paul to the point that they're just about ready to rip him apart. And the Roman commander is there, thinking that this was his way off the hook, and now he's in trouble all over again, and has to have his soldiers rescue Paul one more time and take Paul back to the jail in the Roman barracks. When Paul gets there, I assume that it was a difficult night. That he was discouraged, he was alone, probably really scared. And then Jesus came. Jesus actually showed up to bless him and to encourage him and to assure him that he would get beyond these terrible difficulties that he was in. But just because Jesus came didn't mean that Paul's difficulties went away. Soon after that, there was a conspiracy out in the city of Jerusalem where more than 40 men got together and said, we'll take care of Paul. We're going to murder him. That raised a question of how they would ever get access to Paul while he was in a Roman prison surrounded by the Roman army. So in their conspiracy, they came up with a plan, and that was that they would get some co-conspirators in the Jewish authorities who would go to the Roman commander and request another hearing with Paul. And the 40 plus said that while Paul is being transported from jail to the courthouse, they would murder him. In fact, they took a mutual vow that they wouldn't drink any liquids and they wouldn't eat any food until Paul was assassinated. The trouble with conspiracies, especially if you have more than four dozen in your conspiracy, is it's kind of hard to keep a secret. And the information leaked to a nephew of Paul. And when he found out, he went to visit Paul in jail to tell him that they were out to kill him. Paul decided to use his relationships and pull a few strings with his centurion, whom he'd gotten to know, and as a Roman citizen, and request that his nephew be taken to the commander to tell the story directly to the Roman commander. So the young man, perhaps just a boy, got access to the commander. The commander took him by his hand, listened to the whole story, and sent him away asking him to keep the story quiet while he figured out what to do next. What Paul was doing was using every tool in the box to, it's true, preserve his own life, but to guarantee the advance of the gospel. So he insisted on his rights as a Roman citizen to avoid torture. He utilized his knowledge of Jewish theology in order to escape conviction in a Jewish high court. And he used his family connections and pulled some strings in order to undermine a conspiracy to assassinate him. The crowd listened to Paul until he said that Gentiles could get directly to God. And then they raised their voices and shouted, "Rid the earth of him, he's not fit to live." As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks. He directed that he be flogged and questioned in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. As they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, "Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. "What are you going to do?" he asked. "This man is a Roman citizen." The commander came to Paul and asked, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" "Yes, I am," he answered. Then the commander said, "I had to pay a big price for my citizenship." "But I was born a citizen," Paul replied. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." At this, the high priest, Ananias, ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." Those who were standing near Paul said, "You dare to insult God's high priest?" Paul replied, "Brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. "We find nothing wrong with this man," they said. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin, petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets there." But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, "Paul, the prisoner, sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked, "What is it that you want to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them because more than 40 of them are waiting to ambush him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." Paul used every tool in the box for the sake of the gospel. Roman laws, Jewish theologies, family connections. And that is what we ought to do. Think creatively and act courageously. That's what Billy Graham did. He was often criticized because of the places he went and the people to whom he talked about the gospel of Jesus Christ. It was during the Cold War that he went to Moscow, and there were people in this country who accused him of treason because he went to the capital of the USSR. But Billy Graham insisted that he would go anywhere and talk to anyone about the gospel of Jesus. There are missionaries who today are denied missionary visas and access to many restricted countries around the world. So what they do is they set up businesses, microenterprise loans, and other corporations so that they go in as business persons, benefiting the people of the nation to whom they go, but also communicating the gospel of Jesus. There were American students who were denied the right to study the Bible or to pray on their high school campuses who went to the federal courts and sought federal relief so that they could exercise their freedoms of assembly and speech and worship. And today, because they won in the federal courts, they are allowed to rally around the pole and elsewhere to study the Bible and to pray, all for the sake of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Faith Minute is a new 60-second Wooddale Church radio program that is on sports shows and professional sports broadcasts every day, including today and every day of the week around the Twin Cities, so that the teachings of God and the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ can be heard in places and among people where it would not usually go. Or if you regularly surf the internet, you certainly are aware of YouTube, one of the most popular sites on the internet today, where thousands of people post home videos that are 3 and 4 and 7 minutes long. And many who are Christians are using YouTube to post videos that communicate the truth of God and the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the words of St. Paul, "I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings." God of blessing, we have shared in the blessings through Jesus Christ, and we pray that you will give to us creativity and courage, that we as your agents in the 21st century may do what Paul did in the first century, and that is use every tool available to us to communicate the truth of your Son, in whose name we pray. Amen.